This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Alicia Garza first wrote the phrase Black Lives Matter on Facebook as part of a note to her friends and followers on the day that George Zimmerman was acquitted in the killing of Trayvon Martin. At the time, she had no idea it would become an international phenomenon, but when it did, she and two co-founders responded to the momentum and developed an interconnected on-the-ground movement for racial justice. Black Lives Matter aims to examine and address the many kinds of violence against black communities. Alicia Garza is Special Projects Director for the National Domestic Workers Alliance. She works in Oakland, California, but she's here in North Carolina to give a keynote address at the Black Workers for Justice annual banquet tomorrow and joins us here in our studio today. Alicia, welcome. Good
Thank
to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tell us more about the origins of the Black Lives Matter movement.
Well, as you mentioned, in 2013, when George Zimmerman was acquitted in the murder of Trayvon Martin, I think we saw an initial explosion throughout this country of people who were trying to make sense of the fact that a 16-year-old child could be gunned down in his own community and that his killer would walk free. But certainly the upsurges that we're seeing today are not new and they're not from out of nowhere. I think we could even start in 1992, right, with the L.A. uprisings where folks caught on tape the brutal beating of Rodney King. And then when his aggressors were basically acquitted, an entire community was quite literally set on fire. Fast forward to the murder of Sean Bell in New York, the murder of Amadou Diallo, who was shot 41 times, mistaking a wallet for a gun. And then, of course, just a few blocks from my own home, Oscar Grant being murdered on a BART station platform by Officer Johannes Measurely. And then, of course, Jordan Davis, Renisha McBride. There are so many cases that have become more visible, quite frankly, through the use of technology. So the Black Lives Matter movement, I wouldn't say that we started the movement, but I would certainly say that we helped to spark a flame and really touch the hearts and minds of people who are really looking for a different kind of world where black people's lives actually do matter.
As you say, you didn't start the movement, but it was galvanized around that phrase, which has since been used by many other people and many other movements. Women's Lives Matter, Brown Lives Matter, All Lives Matter. What do you make of that?
You know, one of the things that we find so fascinating is that we live in a country that is built off the legacy and the labor of slavery, yet we have a very hard time talking about the impact of race on our society, on our democracy, and on our economy. And, you know, Black Lives Matter was really intended to both celebrate the resilience of black people who have been resisting state-sanctioned violence for the last 400-plus years, but it was also a call to action, not just for black people, but for all people, to ensure that black lives actually do matter in our society. So when we hear things like all lives matter, it really reflects the kind of current state of things, no pun intended, where we live in a society that, you know, everything and nothing is about race. And so we are really trying to draw attention to the fact that black lives are disproportionately impacted by state-sanctioned violence, and that if we want to live in a world where all lives matter, then we will fight like hell today for black lives.
If I can take the state-sanctioned violence a step further, you might agree that state-sanctioned violence, which is very much a part of the landscape, mm-hmm. and the political landscape of the United States of America, is in service to an economic system, right, that has been utterly legalized, as we saw in 2008. The devastation that was caused by individuals has gone unpunished. And so you have a system of violence, economic and physical violence, all working systemically together. And this particular case, what it means to African Americans, what it means to black people, which is very particular. Is this a complicated story for you? Is this a difficult? There is a structural thing under which all of us, unless you're perhaps some part of 1% of the population, all of us suffer. But there is a particular meaning for black people. Do you have a hard time sorting that out?
No, not at all. I mean, I think what's clear is that this country has been built around a system of racialized capitalism, which, of course, has many, many interplays with patriarchy and heteronormativity and all of these systems, structures, and practices that essentially give unearned privilege to some and disproportionately and devastatingly impacts the lives of others, particularly those who are considered to be people of color, not just in this country, but really around the world. So we know that here in the United States with African Americans, the Malcolm X grassroots movement put out a report several years ago called Operation Ghetto Storm that documented the extrajudicial killings of black people and noted that the rate of those killings was every 28 hours a black person was murdered by police, vigilantes, or security guards. Just in the last few months of 2015, we actually see that that rate is higher. It's really around every 18 hours. In places like Brazil, what we hear from our comrades there is that it's every 6 or 7 hours, and that 77% of the police killings in Brazil are of black people. So it's not hard for us to separate out or sort out. I think the challenge for us is really thinking about how is it that we build a movement large enough and nuanced and complex enough to be able to build the political power we need to advance the alternatives that will save all of our lives.
Given the genius of this system to keep us separated, especially along color lines, how do you do that?
Well, the first thing that we have to do, again, as we mentioned just a few minutes ago, is we have to acknowledge that black people are disproportionately impacted by this type of violence, and that this type of violence, we see it not just in police killings, but we see it in the high levels of un and underemployment. Black folks are largely locked out of an economy now, where we were once part of the foundation of it. We see it in terms of wages, where black folks are on the lowest and lower end of the spectrum when it comes to who's making what. We see it in terms of the privatization of resources, such as our friends in Detroit, where hundreds of thousands of people, mostly black, are having their water privatized. We're seeing it all over the country in various ways. And so we really, really need to invest in building a large, broad-based movement that connects the dots. It's not just about policing. It's also about labor. It's also about human resources. It's also about climate change. It's also about public sector workers and the attacks on them. So once we're able to figure that out, I think we'll have a much easier time at getting what we want. Unfortunately, we also have a responsibility here in the U.S. to pay attention to how is it that we're impacting countries around the world who are also struggling for self-determination. So we have a lot of work to do.
It sounds like you've laid the broad outlines for a new civil rights movement. Would you be comfortable with that kind of characterization?
Well, the black radical tradition is long, and so we tend to ascribe it to a civil rights movement, and certainly it is about social rights, but it's also, quite frankly, about human rights. And that tradition is longer than the 1950s, the 1960s, and the 1970s. I think certainly what we are trying to advance is a movement for black liberation that is both rooted in a long history of struggle and that takes the lessons from those struggles and applies them in a 21st century context where our political conditions are quite different and, in fact, worse than they've been as we know it.
One critique of that 21st century context is that it's become a form of cheap grace, hashtag activism, for instance. How would you respond to that?
Well, I find that to be hilarious because clicking like on Facebook does not a movement make. What movements are built of is relationships, quite frankly, relationships between people who share a vision, who decide that they are going to advance towards that vision together. And they use a number of different tools and tactics in order to get there. Social media is a vehicle for us to get to our goals. It is not the primary vehicle, and it cannot be the only vehicle. What we're seeing with Black Lives Matter is that people are organized on the ground. Just in our network, we have 24 cities across the world who are organizing under the banner of Black Lives Matter and who are connected together to say, you know, we are going to advance policies, practices. We are going to uproot structural racism, not just in our localities, but in our states and hopefully throughout our country and throughout our world.
How do you see that happening? Do you, and again, one of the critiques is for people who don't recognize the long civil rights movement and understand how much organizing was going on in churches and in segregated schools and neighborhoods long before Martin Luther King walked onto the scene, they noticed this visible thing that became what is more commonly known as civil rights movement. Are we in a period like that now where a kind of invisible organization is taking place that could lead to something like that? Or am I looking for the wrong kind of result?
No, I think you're right on the right track. What's real is that right now our realities are shaped by what we see through corporate media. And so people who live in communities where there's organizing happening have no confusion about what it's going to take to change their neighborhoods, to change their communities and their cities. But unfortunately, what's reflected back to us about what's happening in our country and around the world is shaped through a particular lens. And quite frankly, it erases a broad-based movement that is growing right now and focuses much more on sensationalism, on crime. If it bleeds, it leads. And so that tends to be, for those who depend on corporate media for their news, that tends to be the image that folks have, which is why street action is so important. Because it really raises the stakes and really builds the consciousness of folk who may be only getting their news from corporate media. But of course, what we also need is to build political power, and street action is one piece of that. Legislation and policy is one piece of that. But what your question raises to me is that there's also a piece around cultural hegemony that we need to really invest in shifting. We need to create new cultures where we understand much differently who we are in relationship to each other and what that can mean for a different future.
So in terms of order of operations, getting back to your initial point, understanding that this kind of injustice has disproportionately affected black people in America, given the particular history, that coming to terms with that first would then allow people who are also victimized by this and who may be white, first realizing that there are disproportionate consequences to people who are black, understanding that might be the first step to understanding how deeply victimized those working class and middle class white people are by this very same system.
Absolutely. I mean, we ask people to weigh the question of what would your life look like if Black Lives Mattered? What would organized labor look like if Black Lives Mattered? What would our economy look like if Black Lives Mattered? And then from there, what do we want to do about it, right? How do we get to that place? Your question raises to me a couple of things. One is, what is the role of folks who are not Black in a movement that is really rooted and led by Black folks? And the first thing that I would say is that, you know, it's not just Black Americans who are impacted by this, and it's certainly not just people of color who are impacted by state-sanctioned violence. We are all impacted when we have unaccountable policing systems where police are allowed to be judge, jury, and executioner. We are all impacted when we have people who can't make ends meet. We are all impacted when we don't have access to the basic things that we need in order to survive. And we're all impacted when we can't live lives that are full of dignity. And that is something that we all share. And so if we are able to move towards that together, I think what we'll see, counter to Ronald Reagan's kind of trickle down, right, is that we'll see a bubbling up of both a new economy, a new democracy, and a new way of relating to one another. And then, of course, if we are able to consolidate our vision and move together, right, strategically, then we will see a shift in political power that will help us bring about those changes that we want to see.
So right now, what do you think are the biggest barriers to change?
Well, the biggest barriers, I think, is that, one, people still don't understand the insidiousness of racial capitalism. And so what it tends to look like are interpersonal microaggressions that people get really, really focused on. And it's easy to do that because it's some of the most visible things. But quite frankly, if that's all it was, then we could all just go to therapy and sing Kumbaya together and things would be much better. And, you know, we chuckle, but the reality is a lot of the comments that we get are folks who say, you know, why won't you let this race issue die? And if we just didn't talk about it, you know, we're all human beings. All lives matter.
Right.
And we say, you know, we actually need to weed out the impacts of racial capitalism from all of the systems that impact us. So that means things like eradicating the disproportionate sentencing around the same types of drugs. It means really investigating, why are there 1 million black people in prisons and jails in this country? Why does the United States incarcerate more people than any other country around the world, even though we're only 5% of the world's population? this is where we see the real deep-seatedness of racial capitalism. And if we're able to get to those pieces, then we're able to open up a lot of new opportunities for a better world.
So that said, just getting to that big picture is a starting point. But we are focused on these local controversies, these immediate controversies. So when we talk about the particulars, for instance, conversations around police cameras, should police be obligated to wear these? How do you feel about that?
What I think is that we need to really open up police departments for scrutiny. We also need to pay a lot of attention to what I call police corporations and some call police unions that are really threatening the integrity of the labor movement and using the labor movement as a shield for their insidious practices, which include fighting hard to make sure that there is no transparency and no accountability over the people who are supposed to keep us safe. It includes making sure also that our police departments and our police forces are militarized and that we're spending millions and millions, and I would say it's even a billion-dollar industry, bringing tanks and M16s into communities to quote-unquote police them. Number one, it says a lot about the differences between how the police see what their role is in communities. And it also really raises up where there is this racialized policing that's happening, right? What does it mean when you say that a community needs to be under siege, right? So what we're seeing is that policing as it stands right now doesn't actually solve problems. And the police corporations make sure that what they've got is protected. They make sure that their own are protected, even if they do wrong. So what we're really looking for in this moment and what's possible at the local level, right, is to challenge that, is to say, well, if there really are good apples, right, then there's no problem in opening this up for scrutiny so that it can be the best possible. And then there's some of us who really believe that the system of policing is unreformable. I'm one of those people. So we really need to get into this question of what does community safety actually look like? And how do we play roles in holding each other accountable when we commit harms to one another? But how do we do that in a way that allows people to be restored back into their communities? That's an important place of organizing and an important place for movement building.
Well, and that's a big part of your work as well, helping people who want to mobilize in their community, figure out how, what are some of the processes?
Well, one of the things I think that's important is figuring out how do you build with forces who you may not agree with on everything? How do you work together with people you haven't worked together with before? And then there's just the bare bones science and the art of organizing and building relationships. So we get asked to support people in that a lot, and it's one of the greatest things that we like to do. Because quite frankly, that's how we're going to get to where we want to go. The other thing that I think is really beautiful that we're seeing bubbling up all over the country is the projections from people in their communities who are organizing of what they want to see. Those are the images and the dreams that keep us going because we know that we're in an uphill battle. But quite frankly, when we see beautiful images coming out of Ferguson of people who've been resisting for more than 250 days, when we see beautiful images coming out of places like Portland, Maine, right, or coming out of places even like in South Carolina, where folks are saying, you know, enough is enough. We want better systems. We want communities that are safe, and we want to be able to determine those on our own terms. That's what's exciting us today.
But you've also talked about the drain this is, how difficult it is, and how dangerous it is for us to expect that what we saw in terms of organization in Ferguson should be played out and replicated elsewhere.
Well, certainly, because in some ways, Ferguson has become code for Black folks and for racial justice. And Ferguson certainly should be a beacon for us. What Ferguson showed us was how to be courageous, how to shed respectability politics, how to push the envelope, even when people are saying, hey, let's just have closed door meetings because we have access to power. What we're seeing today is that even though we have more Black elected officials than we've ever had, even though we have a Black president, that still has not translated to Black political power. And Ferguson really showed us if we're going to get there, we have to not compromise. We have to be steadfast in our vision and in our goals, and we have to be bold and innovative. So that is a model that should be replicated around the country. But certainly we shouldn't just equate them all. Every place is different and has different needs, but also has something different to contribute.
Alicia, real pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Alicia Garza is the co-creator of Black Lives Matter and the Special Projects Director for the National Domestic Workers Alliance. She's going to give a keynote address at the Black Workers for Justice annual banquet tomorrow, and you can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, Greensboro's surf rock band, Echo Court. Stay tuned.